So here we go. Just to give you guys where we are on things. We did finish the book of Amos, and so destruction and captivity of Israel is where Amos is, his message. So if you want to remember something different, so, you know, Hosea and Amos are both talking to the same group of people. Amos is not from Israel. Hosea is from Israel. And so that's a difference there between the two. We talked about information about the individual, his mission, what he was there to do. His calling is a little bit different than most, and we'll kind of touch on that tonight throughout our study. And so we looked at this section of Scripture, trying to get through the end of chapter 3. We didn't quite get there, and we got right up to the end of chapter 2. And so looking at chapter 3 tonight, we talked about... let me just ask you. This is a quiz me quick kind of question. What was different about Hosea's calling than any other prophet that God had called? What was it that God asked Hosea to do? It was a wee bit different. To get married, but not just marry anybody. Who was he supposed to marry? A woman of harlotry, right? Those are just standing around. And so he marries a woman of harlotry. And what happens in that marriage? She has three illegitimate children, and their names are used to reference kind of a relationship that God had with, or at that time was having. They're not my people, not my children, and that kind of concept in the names. And then he goes into this idea of she is gone. She's going after the harlotry. And then there is in chapter 2 this, he buys her back, right? We're going to talk about that in chapter 3 here. But in chapter 2, we started talking about the lesson that is supposed to be there. In verse 14, we talked about, you know, God wooing Israel back. And almost like they're going back into this date relationship scenario, and things are being removed, and this relationship is being renewed. And so chapter 3 starts with this God talking to the prophet again. And so chapter 3 we have, let's put it up here. So he says, "Then the Lord said to me, 'Go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet adulterous, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel.'" What does this say about Hosea and God, their thoughts or concerns for Gomer? Yeah, so there's still love there, right? There's still love there on the love of a woman who is loved by her husband and yet adulterous. And though they return to their gods and love other gods and love raisin cakes. If you want to write out to the side here, God doesn't like fruitcakes. If you want to write out just to the side there for you. So there's that. Here's what they have done, and they are being called back. Yes, ma'am. So there is debate whether or not those children are actually Hosea's children. She was out running around being a woman of harlotry. After she married. The way the text reads, it lends us to believe that those children are not actually his necessarily. That's the illegitimacy of the children. And that kind of comes around later on in our study as well. We'll touch on that again if we have time to get to that detail. But yes, that's a good question. So the children are more than likely illegitimate, not his per se. So even though she's gone after other gods and been enticed by the raisin cakes, so he buys her. What is the price that he sells? So we have a love for a fallen woman, and then loving discipline. So he buys her back. What does your text say as far as what cost? At what cost? 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley, which, I mean, I don't know. You guys have checked the price of a homer of barley lately. but it's astronomical, right? No, so this is equivalent, this is about equivalent of 30 pieces of silver. So he paid the equivalent of 30 pieces of silver, half in actual silver, the other half in goods. And so this, there's a lot that's been said about this price. In Exodus chapter 21, verse 32, it talks about this is the price if somebody is gored by an ox. If your ox gets out and gores somebody, then you have to pay 30 pieces of silver. That's the going rate. Also, if you, in Leviticus chapter 27, verse 4, the price of a lady, and this is a situation where she might have become property of somebody else, or she might have become a temple prostitute, and so he's buying her back from that kind of service, and so 30 pieces of silver is the price, and so he buys her back. And he said, "Then I said to her, 'You shall stay with me for 40 days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. And I'll be the same towards you. I'll do the same.'" So there's mutual respect in the relationship. And so there's this discipline. And then we have for the sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince, sacrifice, pillar, or without ephod or household idols. What are we talking about in these many days? What's going to happen these many days? Amos said this was going to happen. Hosea is saying it's going to happen. What's going to happen many days for Israel? They're going to go into judgment. They're going to go into captivity. So God say, "I love you," but this still has to happen. This still has to happen. Afterwards, verse 5, and we have this anticipation. "Afterwards, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days." So there is this future idea of a return. there's a lot of debate as far as like how the actual return, did the return kind of with, when the decree of Cyrus and the kind of just those that could come back, because not all of them came back. And a lot of them that did come back just kind of got grouped into other tribes. So what little came back, they were very disjointed and sort of an outcast when they did come back. And we see that play out in the life of Christ, right? Those that the Samaritans were kind of seen as this outcast group. So here we go. That kind of finishes up that imagery, but it still plays a part in the rest of the message, obviously. So God sends this message to Israel through this prophet and in his relationship with this woman, which is not unusual. It's unusual in the type of relationship, but it's not unusual that God would use a prophet and have these type of symbolic lessons. We saw in with Ezekiel, see with Jeremiah and others that have done something as well. So, all right, so now we get into the actual message to the people and the rest of this. So chapters 1 through 3 is, a faithless wife, and now God is dealing with a faithless people as we get into the rest of this. And so we have the sin of the land in chapter 4, and we see kind of what's happening. And so listen to the word of the Lord, which is this prophet saying, listen to the word of God. This is God's message, not mine. And so we see here the sins of the people in verses 1 through 5. "For the Lord has a case against the inhabitants of the land." You'll see a lot in the book of Hosea is this law language. You'll see over and over again sort of law language. And this is one of those cases. This is one of those cases where you have the law language. "I have a case against you." And so he begins to call witnesses. And here's the depravity of the nation. "Because there is no faithfulness or kindness or knowledge of God in the land." There are some have said that you could use these three things to kind of outline the rest of the book as far as what's going on. So there's no faithfulness, kindness, or knowledge of God. And then in verse 2, we have this actual things being brought against them. They're breaking the 9th, 6th, 8th, and 7th commandment, which is never good on any day. They're swearing, deception, murder, stealing, and adultery. You employ violence so that bloodshed follows bloodshed. This is actually literally says blood touches blood. Like you're so violent that what you're doing, you go from one violent act to one violent act, and there's not even enough space between the two violent acts for the blood to like have spread out. You're going for this is like John Wick sin kind of thing going on with what's happening here. It's from one sin to one sin to one sin to one sin, and so it continues. And so therefore, what happens? Because of these things, what happens? Verse 3. The land mourns. Can a land mourn because of sin? What was what did God say that he was doing to the people in with Amos? They're dealing with the same people. What did God say through Amos that he was trying to get the people to wake up? Wake up. What, do you remember what he did? Some of the things he did? What about rain? Did he do anything different with the rain? He stopped the rains for a while. And then when he did make it rain, he made it rain like South Florida. Well, it would rain on one side of the street and not the other, right? It was rain on one city and then not the other cities. And so the land suffered because of the sin. And so those kind of things kind of compound. And so the land, nature, is kind of called into a witness against the people. And so therefore the land mourns and everyone who lives in it languishes. It's obvious to all. Along with the beasts of the field, the birds of the sky, and the fish of the sea, they disappear. There's no place to hide from the sins of the people. Yet let not, no one find fault, and no one offer reproof to these people. For your people are like those who contend with a priest. Have you ever met anybody that would just like argue with an umpire or argue with somebody who's a referee? Have you seen those people? The referee is the authority on the field, right? The supreme authority. You cannot argue with what they say. I mean, you can, but it doesn't get you anywhere, really. And so that's what they're saying here, is that these people are like people who argue with a priest. The priest was God's supreme authority there, and he had given them that authority, and they were arguing with them. And so if somebody who is arguing with the authority of the land, are they going to listen to any kind of fault or any kind of reproof? If you're arguing against authority, are you going to listen to any kind of reproof? No, because you're right. And we'll see later on that they think they're right. But he's saying you're not right. You're not even going to listen. If you want to write out here Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 12, beside verse 4, Deuteronomy 17, verse 12, you will stumble by day, and the prophet will also stumble by night, and I will destroy your mother. This is the homeland, this professional prophet, those who are there, there's not going to be anybody left. So everybody is going to be going away. This next verse is really sad. Verses 6 through 10, my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. Because they have rejected knowledge, the priests and those that are there, I will also reject you from being my priests, since you have forgotten the law of your God. This is not a good scenario. Not good. Right? So here, their whole relationship with God is based on the commandments he's given them, and they've forgotten them. They've gone their own way, done their own thing. We'll see this kind of over and over again. And so the rebuke there is, I will also forget your children. The more they multiply, the more they sin against me. I will change their glory into shame. They feed on the sin of my people. So instead of correcting the sin, they're capitalizing on sin. Nobody does that anymore, right? So those who were supposed to be correcting sin are capitalizing on it. And we'll see then that these kind of same kind of themes get kind of played over again in different ways throughout this book. and so we see here this, and it will be like people like priests. So there is no hierarchy anymore. There's not like the priest can just stand off and say, we are priests and you are people and we do something different. It's like, no, everybody sinned and everybody will be punished. And everybody will be paid for their deeds. They will eat and not have enough. They will play the harlot and not increase because they have stopped giving heed to the Lord. There are people who are just trying to take in, and they can never have enough in any of their situation here. And so they will have stopped giving heed to the Lord. And this is something that this theme over and over again throughout this book. So we have the sin of idolatry, which they never got rid of. And then this warning to Judah as well included in this chapter. Harlotry, wine, and new wine take away understanding. We can get an amen on that, right? And so this is an influence of the Baal and cult worships. That they had brought into, they were meshing, not only did they kind of take their own system and make a new system of worship, but they blended in other cultural, appropriations from the nations around them and kind of mixed and made this kind of superfluous kind of religion. And so part of their worship, it involved worshiping the Baals and in very different ways. And so here they are. And what did he say about, in verse 12, what are they doing with these wooden statues and diviner's rod? What are they doing to the statues and the diviner's rod? Where are they going to? What are they trying to seek? They're trying to seek information from. Let me just say it. They're trying to seek information from these false sources, right? A wooden statue that they carved, and then this diviner's rod. You know, they're trying to get information from them. And this idea of spirit of harlotry has led them astray. It's repeated throughout the book, spirit of harlotry. This is the idea that they have just been led off completely into this idea of going after other gods or going after against what God is. Once they kind of got the bug of harlotry, it just stuck with them. And so they continue to change what God's given them. And they played the harlot departing from their God, verse 12. And so over and over again, we talk about what they do, and he says here in verse 14 that he's not going to punish the daughters or the brides when they're adulterous, because why? The end of verse 14. Because the men are doing it too. Like, everybody's doing this. I'm not going to just punish them. You all are going to be punished. So the people without understanding are ruined. If you want to write out here, just for a little interesting side note, John 8, verse 7, Him who was without sin cast the first stone, and so they were all with sin, and so they were all going to be punished, and so Judah is also kind of brought up in this. Judah has been guilty of some of the same kind of things at this point, and so they have this mention of Judah. Now, it mentions Gilgal, and what should be normally Bethel. The word Bethel, or the name Bethel, means house of God. Beth, house, El, God, house of God. But he has it here, Beth-Aven, which means a house of nothingness or house of vanity. And so God changes. So here's a place that was supposed to be like your place where you're going to go worship God, air quotes, is basically what God is saying. And he's calling it the house of vanity or house of nothingness. In relationship to their system of worship. And so God's twisting the names around and using that. Hopefully they understand what's going on. And so they go up there and say, as the Lord lives, and they take this oath, but they're stubborn. What's the imagery in verse 16 that he uses for their stubbornness? A stubborn heifer. Which not many of us have dealt with a stubborn heifer before, but let me tell you what, right? So, again, they can be stubborn. And so a lamb also in a large field, just even like a pet. Have you ever tried to get your dog in a large area that won't come to you and just keeps running away? So annoying. Anyway, talk to me later about it. But so this is that idea that they will not come under subjection to what God has given them or told them to do. Ephraim is joined to idols. Let them alone. Their liquor gone. They play the harlot continually. Rulers. You might have here shields in verse 18. This concept of rulers. And so this destruction that was coming to them. And they will be ashamed because of their sacrifices. There will come a time when they're ashamed of what they've done. But it won't be today. Right? It's not going to be today. And so we get through chapter 4. Let me get into chapter 5. The judgment of the land. Start looking at this chapter, impartiality of the sentence, and looking at what's happening here. How does he start this chapter? Yes, listen up, right? Listen up, everybody. O priest, O house of Israel, O house of the king, nobody is exempt from what's about to be dropped. Listen, for the judgment applies to you. You have been a snare at Mizpah, which is to the east, and you have set a net out on Tabor, which is to the west. So from the east to the west in your area, you have been nothing but a snare to the people. And so we have the revolters have gone deep in depravity or have waded deep in slaughter is what some of your translations might say, is what it literally says. The revolters are those that have turned aside. So if you want to read this literally, those that have turned aside have waded deep into slaughter. Not a good place to be, right? God's really kind of calling them out here on what's going on. But he says, I will chastise all of them. No one will escape what's going to happen. And so we have this basis for the sentence. And then we get into necessity, certainty, and portraits of judgment for this chapter. And so looking at this in verses 4 and 5, the necessity, their deeds will not allow them to return to their God. For again, for a spirit of harlotry is within them, they do not know the Lord. Later on, we'll get to a point where we'll say, hey, we know God. But God is saying this whole time, you don't know me. You don't know me.
they have forgotten. Moreover, the pride of Israel testifies again. So again, more testimony against them, the pride of Israel. And it's Israel and Ephraim stumble in their iniquity. Judah also stumbled with them, guilty of the same kind of thing. They will go with their flocks and their herds to seek the Lord, but they will not find him. Why would you take flocks and herds to seek the Lord? Because they followed you to school one day? Why would you take them? Sacrifices, right? He said, you're going to go and you're going to take all your flocks and your herds and you're going to sacrifice, but you're not going to find God. You're not going to find him. They will seek him and not find him. He has withdrawn from them. They have dealt treacherously against the Lord. Whenever you see this, dealt treacherously against the Lord, it's the same kind of language that was used with an adulterous woman. If you had a case against an adulterous woman. So over and over again, that theme kind of plays over in this book. You've dealt treacherously against the Lord, for they've borne illegitimate children. And this can be that literally they have borne illegitimate children. They were not supposed to have relations with other nations, right? But they possibly brought them in. Or it's figuratively, obviously, with their sins and that kind of stuff, illegitimate children and what they're doing. So either way, not good what's happening. The new moon and talking about their feasts and things. And so we have this alarm in verse 8. Blow the horn, the trumpet, and sound the alarm again in Bethaven, the house of vanity. Behind you, O Benjamin. And so here we have this possible warning to Judah as well. Ephraim will become a desolation, a day of rebuke. Among the tribes of Israel, I'll declare what is sure. It is not the people saying what's true. It's God saying, this is what's true, this is what's going to happen, and it's not going to be good. Even Judah gets caught up. When the Assyrians come in, Judah does not get out scot-free. They have issues as well when Assyria comes in, and they have to deal with some things as well. And so they are being kind of lumped in with some of this. The princes of Judah have become like those who move a boundary. Right out here, Deuteronomy chapter 27, verse 17. Deuteronomy chapter 17, or 27, verse 17, they are cursed, those that move a boundary. And so on them I'll pour out my wrath like water, because he has determined to follow man's command. Again, this they don't know who God is. And he's going to be against them at this point. Portraits of judgment. We have this idea of the defendant in verse 11. You have rot and decay in verse 12 with the moth and rottenness. You have an incurable wound in verse 13. In verse 14, a rampaging lion, which we've seen. Remember Amos, whenever we talked about him, he was the roaring lion, the voice of God, this roaring lion. And so we have these images here, portraits of judgment. And they'll go to these different kings. They're unable to heal or cure. And God will be like a roaring lion. I will tear to pieces and go away. I will carry away, and there will be none to deliver. I will go away and return to my place until they acknowledge their guilt and seek my face. In their affliction, they will earnestly seek me. And so God is saying, I love you, but this has got to happen, right? I love you, but this has to happen. And this is what he's saying, I will do this thing. So when Assyria comes, it's not some random thing that's happening. God is saying, so they do not forget, it is I, God, is doing this thing to you. Chapter 6, we have an appeal to repentance. A couple exhortations here in these first few verses. So here we have this kind of idea, come, let us return to the Lord, this exhortation, for he has torn us, and he will heal us. He has wounded us, and he will bandage us. He will revive us after 2 days. He will raise us up on the third day, that we may live before him. So here's the exhortation, and then the imperative, or the reason why, incentive. And so he has healed us, or he has wounded us, and he will heal us. In verse 2, we have this, he will raise us up on the third day. You can write out here Ezekiel chapter 37, verses 1 through 10, this idea of being raised up. And Ezekiel deals with the dry bones. This is not a new concept with the prophets. You can also write out here, although it doesn't explicitly tie this in, but 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 4, this is almost word for word, that as well. So if you want to write out there, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 4, who was raised up on the third day? Excellent. Very good. Yes. And so that we may live before him, which
is interesting. These little dots in here of these things. And then the second exhortation, so let us now press on to know the Lord, his going forth as is certain as the dawn, and he will come unto us like rain, and will spring rain watering the earth. And so here's this again, this exhortation to know God, and then the reason why, the incentive for knowing him. And so we have this kind of an appeal to repentance. And then we get into this other charge and contrast, mercy, not sacrifice, or superficial religion. And so we have a charge against them. What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? Anybody heard that before from the parents? What am I going to do with you? It's usually not good, right? What shall I do with you, O Judah? So both of them are kind of included here. Your loyalty or loving kindness is like a morning cloud and dew which goes out away early. And so their loving kindness or their loyalty is not great. They're not known for that. Therefore, I've hewn them in pieces by the prophets. I've slain them by the swords of my mouth. What does that remind you of? Hewn them in pieces with the prophets and slain them with the swords of my mouth. Does it bring any imagery, New Testament imagery, into your mind? If we look at Revelation chapter 3, what this image of Christ, what is his tongue? I'm sorry, Revelation 1:16. This sword coming out of the mouth of Christ. So this message, so if you want to write up there, Revelation 1 verse 16. And so he says, these things are going to be, so the message of the prophets, and then the words of my mouth. And the judgments on you are like the light that goes forth. So these judgments are as obvious as light and darkness. These are obvious. And so he says, for I delight in loyalty or loving kindness rather than sacrifice. Matthew 9:13, if you want to write out here. Matthew 9:13. And in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. So the ritual and relationship to God go together. So you can't have one. So you can have relationship without ritual is not right, and ritual without relationship isn't right. They kind of have to go together in order to be right. You can't just go through, you know, checking off the boxes, but have no real relationship with God. You're just going through the actions. And you can't say, well, I have this relationship with God, but I don't believe in organized religion. That doesn't work either, right? That doesn't work. They kind of have to go together in the right balance and keeping things in perspective the way God wants them to be. And so we get over into this contrast again. But like Adam, they have transgressed the covenant. There they have dealt treacherously against me. Again, that idea of an unfaithful wife. And so we have this idea, contrast, confirmation in the... Oh, I didn't put that up there, did I? I'm trying to hurry through this. I'm sorry, I should be putting this up here more quickly. Gilead is a city of wrongdoers, tracked with bloody footprints. This goes back to, blood after blood after blood in their sins. They're walking in that blood. As raiders wait for a man, so a band of priests murder on the way to Shechem. That goes way beyond, right, the Good Samaritan story, right? So in these days, the priests are the ones that are besetting those who are in the way. And said, surely they've committed a crime. In the house of Israel, I've seen a horrible thing. There are some writers who have said that this, a horrible thing, could literally be translated, makes hair stand up, this horrible thing. And so there is this horrible thing. Ephraim's harlotry is there. Israel's defiled itself. Also, Judah, there is a harvest appointed for you when I restore the fortunes of my people. So a future time of judgment for Judah as well is rolled into here. So there's a lot of things that Judah's also guilty with in some of these things. And so they are not left out of this judgment. So looking into chapter 7, where are we on time? We might make it. Looking into chapter 7, mercy and not violence. And looking at what's happening here in this chapter. When I would heal Israel, the iniquity of Ephraim is uncovered, and the evil deeds of Samaria, for they deal falsely, and their thief enters the bandits outside. So you have lying and violence. People aren't trying, and this is beyond what's possible now. So God says, when I would heal Israel, the iniquity of Ephraim is uncovered. What I would do,
I would do this, but they're not even trying to be healed. God isn't going to just, you know, heal them without them trying to do their part and returning to Him, and they're not returning. They're making it more plain. And so they have continued to do the things. It says, "For they do not consider in their hearts that I remember all their wickedness." They will be held accountable for what they're doing. He said, "Now their deeds are all around them. They are before my face." And this is not something that is obviously a pretty thing. When we think about things that go up before God, we think about sacrifices, right? We think about prayers. We think about incense, those things that are a sweet-smelling aroma. And these things that are in front of His face are probably anything but sweet-smelling aroma that's before Him. He says, "With their wickedness they make the king glad and the princes with their lies." So even the king and the princes are in on this, those that should know better. "They are all adulterers, like an oven heated by the baker, who ceases to stir up the fire from the kneading of the dough until it's leavened." So their sins, they burn for these kind of sins, and we see this taking place. In verses 5, beginning of verse 5, we had this idea of kind of a coup. So on the day of our king, this festival occasion, princes become sick with heat of wine, and he stretched out his hand with scoffers. For their hearts are like an oven as they approach the plotting. Their anger smolders all night, and in the morning it burns like flaming fire. So there's this idea of going up against the king. All of them are hot like an oven, and they consume all their rulers. All their kings have fallen. None of them calls on me. I mean, what's interesting, after Jeroboam, so this is during the time, up until the time of Jeroboam II, things were relatively stable. And then after Jeroboam II dies, there are four kings that are killed, just kind of coup after coup after coup after coup that takes place after Jeroboam II. And so he's talking about that kind of plotting against the authorities there. And instead of looking to God in this situation, none of them looked to God in any of this. And so we see this plotting. And so mercy, not violence. And then they go into the political intrigue. And so they have this, their policy is, as far as their foreign policy, is kind of laid out here by God. Ephraim mixes himself with the nations, which they were commanded not to do. Ephraim has become a cake not turned. And so there. Here is this, I don't know if you ever forgot to flip the flapjack, like the pancake, and it's burnt on one side and like gooey on the top. So that's what they are. They're not doing anything well. They can't worship God well, and they can't pretend to be Baalites well either.
Huh? I thought it was, you know, I have to turn a cake, otherwise it doesn't cook evenly.
Well, my cakes don't do that way. I think in the Hebrew in between here, it actually talks about Bisquick cakes. Yeah. So. Sure, you can have your cakes, but the idea is they're not doing either of them well. They're not doing it well, right? We're not worshiping God well, obviously. They don't even know who He is. And on the other side, they're trying to be like these other nations that follow after Baal, and they're not doing that well either. And so their policy allows strangers to devour their strength, and He doesn't know it. Isn't that the worst case scenario? To be weak and in a weakened position but not know it? Is that a bad scenario to be in? Not good, right? Because here you are, I'm trying to do things like I've always done them and act like I always act, but I don't realize I'm in a weakened state. And what normally happens then? Things break, right? Things fall apart. And so he doesn't know it. And though the pride of Israel testifies against him, here again that pride testifying, yet they have not returned to the Lord their God. They're not learning. They're not learning by what God's telling them, nor have they sought Him for all of this. And God's saying, for all that's going on, they're not looking to me, which is what they should be looking. So Ephraim has become like a silly dove without sense. So their foreign policy is just going back and forth, whoever they think is the strongest. They call to Egypt, and they go to Syria, and they go back and forth. And historically, we see that take place. They're trying to go back and forth who they think can give them the best protection. And he says, when they go, I will spread my net over them. I will bring them down like birds of the sky. I will chastise them in accordance with the proclamation of their assembly. So these things are going to happen. They're going to be brought down. Verse 13, woe to them. A disastrous policy. Woe to them, for they have strayed from me. Because of that, the reward of that destruction is theirs. For they have rebelled against me. I would redeem them, but they speak lies against me. If you want to tie that down into verse 16, we'll get there in just a second. They speak lies against me. I just took like drew an arrow down to the end of verse 16, and we'll get there. And they do not cry to me from their heart in gratitude towards God when they wail on their beds. For the sake of grain and new wine, they assemble themselves. They turn away from me. Although I trained and strengthened their arms, yet they have devised evil against me. Also tie that down into verse 16. What is God saying? I'm the one that prepared you. I'm the one that gave you all that you are, made you everything, and you devise against me. They turn, but not upward. They're like a deceitful bow. I don't know if you've ever practice archery, anybody? But there are certain bows at camp. Gary can attest to this. At camp, there are certain bows in the archery game that work well, and there are certain bows that look like they should do well, but will always shoot hard right, or they'll slap your arm will look like this welt, right? Because they're a treacherous bow, and so that's what God is saying about these people. They look like they should do what they're supposed to do. But when it comes down to it, you will hurt for being in a relationship with them. You can't lean on them. They are a deceitful bow. Their princes will fall by the sword because of the insolence of their tongue. This is what I was kind of tying into. They speak lies against God. They speak evil against God because of the insolence of their tongue. This will be their derision in the land of Egypt. Or this Egypt is that idea. They actually don't go to Egypt, but Egypt is that idea of bondage. And so we have that against them. In chapter 8, if we can get through this rather quickly. Yes. So again, this idea of the trumpet. Put the trumpet to your lips. Again, another warning. How is the enemy going to be coming? Verse 1 of 8. I have like an eagle, the enemy comes against the house of the Lord. So is that slow? You have a vulture? You need an update. I don't know what version you're reading, girl, but you need an update. You got cakes and vultures over there. Okay. So an eagle or a vulture, a bird of prey, is coming against them. We have this idea. So fast, swiftly against the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant, circle that, and have rebelled against my law, circle that. So we have this that they're doing. They cry out to me, my God, we of Israel know you. What has he said this whole time? They don't know him. How do we know they don't know him? Well, God says that they don't know him, but do their actions betray them? Right? Their actions betray them. We know you, but this is a false claim. Israel has rejected the good, verse 3. The enemy will pursue them. They have set up kings, but not by me. They have appointed princes, but I didn't know it. With their silver and gold, they have made idols for themselves, and they might be cut off. So we have illegitimate rulers, man-made rulers, and then we have in verse 5, illegitimate or illegal religion, man-made religion. He has rejected your calf, O Samaria, saying, my anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable of innocence? Just so you know, like when you read through the Minor Prophets and you see these things, God contending with man, there's a lot of these kind of things that are super relevant today, right? And this idea of innocence, how long will they be incapable of innocence? Has it been a while since innocence has really been something that has been talked well of or spoken good of, innocence? It's been a while that we don't talk about innocence. From Israel even to this, the craftsman made it, so it is not God. So again, God's talking about this option. And I want you to write out here or think about this. A craftsman made it, so it is not God. That works for idols, and that works for false doctrines, right? If a craftsman made it, it's not God. If it's not spoken by God, if God didn't make it and God didn't speak it, then it's not God's. That works on what is made and what is said as well. And so he talks about these things being broken in half. They sow the wind and they'll reap the whirlwind. Not something that you want to be involved in. The standing grain has no heads and it yields no grain. Shout it. Should it yield anything, strangers are going to swallow it up. So what they're producing in the future is not going to be good. And even if it does, they're not going to be around to enjoy it. Israel is swallowed up and they're among the nations like a vessel in which no one delights. You go to somebody's house and you're looking for a good coffee cup. And there's that coffee cup in the back that nobody uses. That's Israel. It's not pretty and it's not useful. Is basically what he's saying. That here's a vessel that nobody wants to use, and no one delights in it. And that we see what's happening. In verse 9, he again talks about their stubbornness, but what image does he use now? A wild donkey, right? A wild donkey, all alone. Ephraim has gone after, like a wild donkey has gone after, their hired lovers, and even though they hire allies among the nations, now I will gather them up into exile. And I will begin to diminish because of the burden of the kings of princes. And so he's talking possibly about this tribute that will future will have to be paid because of Assyria. And so he's going to be diminishing them. Do I have all these up here? I'm not putting these all up here. Let me just go ahead and do the whole chapter. There we go. Verse 12, why is this important? What does he say? Though I wrote for him, Ephraim, 10,000 precepts of my law, they are regarded as a strange thing or something foreign. They're completely ignoring, discounting what God has written for them. They don't, again, over and over again, they don't know God. And if you don't know God, you definitely don't know his law. Those things go hand in hand. Yes, sir? I'm sorry? Yes, yeah. If God has written what is said, if I change it, it becomes a denomination. It becomes something other than what God has written. And so here they are regarded as a strange thing. As for my sacrificial gifts, they sacrifice the flesh and eat it, or it's just meat to them. It's interesting that he says the flesh. It's just meat. It's not even anything to him. It's not a real sacrifice. The Lord has no delight. Now he will remember their iniquity. So where a sacrifice, a blood sacrifice, would have, you know, he would not have remembered their iniquity. Now, because he doesn't recognize their sacrifices, guess what? I will remember your iniquity, and I will punish them for their sins, and they will return to Egypt. Again, idea of bondage. For Israel has forgotten its maker and built palaces, and Judah has multiplied fortified cities. But I will send a fire on the cities, and that will consume their palace dwellings. And so, again, Judah's brought into this. Israel has forgotten his maker and trusted in palaces and riches. Judah has multiplied their trust, has been in fortified cities. Now, during this time, Israel and Judah were not playing nice together. Israel and Judah were fighting. And so that's probably why they're building fortified cities in the north. And that kind of stuff. But if you trust in your fortified cities and you trust in your palaces, God is saying that is not where you should put your trust. In the end, he will consume those things. Any thoughts or questions, comments? I recognize we're going through this rather hurriedly. There's a lot here to kind of, we could slow down and look at. We just don't have the time. But hopefully we're getting an idea of the overall idea or message of what's happening. It's not good to be an inhabitant of Israel in the time of Amos and the time of Hosea. All right, thank you very much for your time tonight. I appreciate it.